Welcome back to The Daily Drum on WHUR and Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. It is the beginning of the second week of the Derek Chauvin murder trial. From the emotional testimony...
Oh, my God.
Just give me a moment, Mr. McDonald. I'm not sure if there's water as well. If you need a break to get some water, let me know.
To the combative comments of some of the witnesses.
I heard George Floyd saying, I can't breathe, please get off of me. I can't breathe. He cried for his mom. He was in pain.
This could be considered the latest trial of the decade. Well, tonight, we take a look at the trial and the law and the politics of the Derek Chauvin trial. My guests are Debbie Hines, former Baltimore prosecutor and legal analyst, and Timothy Williams, retired homicide detective and expert in police procedure and use of force. And you, our listener, give us a call. I want to know what you think about this trial so far as we begin the second week. Lines are open. Give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. I invite you to tweet me at HFisherWHUR or find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Tim, thanks for joining us again. Good to have you on the program.
Well, thanks for having me again.
Absolutely. And Debbie, thank you for being on the program as well.
Oh, thank you.
Let's start at today, where we saw the police chief testifying against someone who used to be one of his own. How unusual is that, Debbie?
Well, it's really very unusual, and it was quite compelling for the chief to testify, because that's the problem in many of these cases, is that the officers, you know, they stick together, and even if they are forced in any way to testify because they were a witness to something, they try to just paint it in the light most favorable to the defendant, the police officer on trial. But this police chief is different because he came out almost immediately the day after he saw the video when a community person came to him as he testified and asked him, Chief, have you seen one of your officers kill this man? And he immediately fired Chauvin. So he was just outraged at what he saw, and that should tell us all how egregious this was, even from the police officer's perspective. So it's just very compelling to listen to the chief, who's, you know, worked his way up from the ranks. He started out in 1989 and started out on the, you know, like every other police officer, walking the street, being on the beat, and he worked his way all the way up now to being the police chief of Minneapolis Police Department. So it's extremely unusual for a police chief to, you know, to testify, and then in the past for him to have been as vocal as he was, because if you recall in all the other cases, I'm just thinking recently of Eric Garner, where we saw a similar instance. You know, that police officer remained on the force for 5 years. The chief didn't fire him right away.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Tim, you had nearly three decades as a robbery and homicide detective and police officer. I don't think it's a stretch to say you know a murder when you see it. But is this a slam dunk for you?
There is nothing that's a slam dunk. The people have to prove their case. And I think that the people have laid out a very, very extremely strong foundation from last week. What you've seen is the police department coming forth and testifying that what their own employees have done is, in fact, out of policy, is, in fact, what they were not trained to do, and it was wrong. You've seen a chief today that has set the tone for law enforcement leadership all across the country. These folk can't be hide behind their desks anymore. Here is a man that came up. He was up front and down front, as my father used to say. And he told it just like it was. He called balls, and he called strikes. the senior lieutenant last week on the department, he was a senior person on the department, called it like it was. He called balls, and he called strikes. And his supervisor, Chauvin's supervisor, who has retired, called it like it was. So the thing is that, you know, you talk about the blue cold of silence. Well, what you have seen in these last three officers, they shattered that wall. And they came out and told it like it was. The people or the prosecution has so far on a very strong case. And I think that if they have laid the foundation for the house they're trying to build, and I think that it will stand.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are talking about the Derek Chauvin murder trial, the former Minneapolis police officer accused of killing George Floyd last May. If you have a comment, if you have a question, we invite you to call at 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. So, Debbie, as far as a prosecutor's quill of arrows, last week the emotion started on day one. Do you believe that and the video that, in some cases, that we saw for the very, very first time remains the most powerful evidence in the trial for the prosecution?
So I think it remains most powerful to people who are moved by emotions. There are 12 people on the jury. It was definitely most powerful to me because I'm a very emotional person. But there are others on the jury who are more methodical, more not unemotional, but more methodical in just how they approach life and how they approach things. But there is no doubt that last week's testimony, the way it started with all of the witnesses, it was powerfully emotional. And to see all of those witnesses feel responsible in some way, that they have guilt. Some of them, you know, just about all of them said that they thought that they could do more. The 17-year-old, now 18-year-old, who took most of the video that was the 8 minutes, 46-second video that now we know was really 9.5 minutes in reality, she spoke about how she goes to bed and apologizes to George Floyd for not being able to do more. So, yes, it was extremely emotional. All of those individuals, those witnesses that were there on the scene, they're probably joined together for life in this incident. And I hope that they are all getting some type of emotional and psychological counseling from what we've heard from their testimony. But there's also, you know, jurors who, yes, they may be moved by that, but they may not. There may be a few who still need to see more in terms of proof. And that's what we have on week two, starting today, where we have the police officers and also the training. I don't know if she's an officer, but Ms. Blackwell, who said there was no way that that was taught in any way, shape, or form in training, what Chauvin did. So we're into phase two of the trial, but there's no doubt if you had an emotional bone in your body, you would have been moved by each and every witness from last week.
I wanted to drill down just a little bit more on that in just a bit, but let me take a phone call. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We're talking about the Derek Chauvin murder trial, second week underway today. This is the former Minneapolis police officer accused of killing George Floyd last May. Let's talk to Tonda, calling from D.C. Tonda, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. I just wanted to say that looking at the trial, it's painful. I experienced something similar to myself. I had a lawsuit back in 2009 against my employee with the District of D.C. Fire and EMS Department. I was currently working for them at the time, and people that was on the trial with people currently still working with the fire department. So it touched home to see the police officers that work with the Chauvin guys. The feedback was heart-wrenching because you still got to go to work and work with these people. You still got to, you know, but you want to do the right thing as a human being. I just want people to know that it's painful to watch, but it's not easy. It's not an easy, like they said, slam dunk. Just because you see what happened with it, that's not what's all going to happen with the case.
Mm-hmm.
The prosecutor has to build their case to make it look one way, and the defendants build their case to make it seems like Mr. George Floyd is on trial.
Yeah,
that's what they do. Okay. They kind of switch it up and, you know, try to make it seem that he's the bad guy with it. They try to cover up a lot of things.
Okay.
So for me, like I said, is I only watch bits and pieces of it. I cannot watch the whole thing. Because
okay.
It just brings back memories of my own personal experience.
Tonda, thank you so much for your phone call. And to that point, Debbie, I believe it was on the second day there was a juror who was overwhelmed and emotionally overwhelmed. She left the jury box and had later taken the stand. We did not see this. Of course, this was reported, and she said that because of the video and some of the emotional testimony that she had lost sleep and was having some other emotional issues as a result of this. Do you believe that that is something that is beneficial to the prosecution or detrimental to the prosecution of this case when a juror becomes so emotionally overwhelmed by something that is obviously difficult for everyone to see?
That's absolutely beneficial for the prosecution. I mean, when I was talking about different jurors, that's the type of juror that you want. You want a juror to think from the heart. And I'm speaking not just to this case, but for any case that, you know, I prosecuted. You don't want them really analyzing too much of the evidence and getting drawn in back and forth with the medical examiner and the autopsy and could it be this and could it be this and what about that. You want that type of juror. So she would be a juror that, in my estimation, would be very favorable to the prosecution, one who is so moved by it. And I don't know if this was that juror because we don't really know that much about the jurors, but there is one juror who didn't see the video at all. There's actually one, you know, not even, you know, any part of the video. So I don't know if it was that particular juror who might have been watching the video for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And that may have been the reason why that particular person, you know, broke down. But yes, that is who I would want, or my jury, if I were prosecuting this case.
Timothy, how difficult is it to prosecute police officers? And is this, we still don't know, obviously, the outcome. The prosecution is presenting its case. The defense is cross-examining. But outside of the question about a slam dunk, you know, historically, prosecuting police officers is not an easy task.
No, it's not. After spending almost 30 years in law enforcement, then in my practice, dealing with police procedure use of force and wrongful conviction for the past 18 years, going on almost 47 years next month, is that there is a lot of times you don't see an appetite from the jury to, in my opinion, to do the right thing. And that's why you see so many not guilties or in the civil rights cases, you know, cases not being the department not being held liable for their actions because there's not an appetite a lot of times for doing the right thing. So the thing is that, you know, you've got to look, and I have to agree with Debbie, you know, you can't go out there and say, well, this is a slam dunk, that's a slam dunk, and this juror who had this meltdown, so to speak. You have to pray, and because I was on the prosecution side for almost three decades, you've got to pray that that person has the endurance to stay on the trial.
Mm-hmm.
And that's important.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Rob, quickly, calling from Baltimore, what's on your mind?
I just want to say, first of all, that I had read maybe a year ago when this trial first came to national attention, that there was some type of history between Mr. Floyd and also the police officer in question. I think Mr. Floyd was some type of a nice security guard, and I think they had some type of run-in before. And so there was a personal animus between those two guys, which could have actually resulted in what went on. That's my first point. My second point I want to say is that it's to me, it's always incredibly it's surreal to me that we always have these same scenarios where a police officer, generally, you know, a man, you know, a European man, uses deadly force against a man of color. But my question is always the same. Are white police officers getting different training in the police academy as opposed to men of color? Because it seems to me that we never seem to hear about African-American or any other police officer of color with any type of degree of regularity using deadly force unnecessarily.
Well, hold your point, Rob. Stay on the line because I want our experts to address your question. Also, Jackie, calling from D.C., your phone call is next. Lines are still open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. If you're having difficulty getting through, please keep trying. I promise I will take your phone call. We're taking calls all the way up until 8 o'clock. Stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. John Mons is next with the original Quiet Storm on WHUR. This discussion continues on Sirius XM Channel 141 and 96.3 HD2. Don't forget to download the 96.3 HD2 app to your phone. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight we are looking at the Derek Chauvin trial, the law, the trial, and the politics. My guests are Debbie Hines, former Baltimore prosecutor and legal analyst, and Timothy Williams, retired homicide detective and expert in police procedure and use of force. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. At first blush, Tim, the answer probably would be, well, of course, you know, the training that officers get, no matter what their color, is the same. But someone has raised that, and I don't think it is a question that comes from nowhere. Your thoughts about that?
Yes. The training both black and white, Hispanic male and female, Asian officers get is the same in the academy, throughout their continuing education, and throughout their career. They get the same training. Here's the difference. Policing is different in white communities than in minority communities. That's the difference. What you see in a more of an aggressive approach in the minority communities of black and Hispanic communities than you see in the white communities, and there's a difference. In my book, I talk about Rodeo Drive. There's two Rodeo Drives in Southern California. One in the minority community now is the Barack Hussein Obama Boulevard, and the other Rodeo Drive is in Beverly Hills. The Rodeo Drive in the minority community gets a very aggressive policing. The Rodeo Drive in Beverly Hills gets a shake the hand, take a picture type of policing. So same geographic area, 5 miles apart, you get two different types of policing, very aggressive in a minority community and a hug and greet in the white community.
But here's another question that may be applicable to what Rob is also asking. Even if the training is the same, police officers are not the same. There is, of course, the culture of blue. But there is also the culture that different officers come from, black officers, brown officers, white officers, Asian officers. They all bring their own culture to policing. And might that also impact how they interact with communities of color versus white communities?
I would say yes, but it goes back to the recruitment and the vetting individuals as they come onto the department. If you got to come onto the department and obtain your core values, then that's the wrong person to be hiring in law enforcement. Yes, we all have our biases, but there's certain core values you got to bring on and with you, and that you should have gotten at home from your mother and father. One is reverence for life. Or as talked about in the policy, sanctity for life, and the other one is compassion, one for your fellow man. Now you see a lot of that is absent, and that's something that you can't teach in the academy. That's something that you got to bring and it's something that you've learned from a child. And again, what you're seeing as far as background investigators and investigation, you have I call them gatekeepers. The same mentality. And until that changes, until that aspect of it is reformed, you'll see the same issues decade after decade.
Rob, thank you so much for your question. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Let me go to Jackie calling from D.C. Jackie, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Oh, thanks for having this forum.
Sure.
I watched the chief's testimony today and the inspector's testimony today, and they showed footage to support Chauvin's opinion. Perspective that his knee was on the shoulders of Brother Floyd. I have to agree with the chief that before the ambulance arrived to collect this brother's body, he was already dead, and you could see that he was deceased, and they were handling his dead body in a very hostile, aggressive, and nasty way. It was just dehumanizing. And then finally, my final comment is that I live in an all-black community in Ward 8. And over where I live, all of the police officers are white. And there is a problem in this community with those white police officers and our children. Now, I don't know what formula or training they have that's going to change hiring a bunch of white police officers in an all-black community. But at the end of the day, the concoction is deadly for our children and for our community. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Jackie. Debbie, one of the things that came out when the paramedics were testifying last week, and this goes to the heart of what Jackie was talking about, a load and go. Are you familiar with that term as it relates to, you know, taking a patient quickly and putting them on the stretcher and then into the ambulance?
Yeah, as it was in the trial, as it was testified in the trial.
I'm sorry, please say that again, please.
As it was, yes, as the term was used in the trial.
Yeah, so what is that? Because I think we need to be, you know, in order to be, you know, fair, there is, you know, there are people such as Jackie who is saying that, you know, she believes that George Floyd, he was still a patient, not declared dead, was not handled with grace and care. But then there are others who may be, you know, medical professionals who may be looking at the need for haste. Talk to me a little bit about those two comparisons.
Yeah, so those paramedics that arrived on the scene to George Floyd, they were compassionate because, unfortunately, they had to even ask Chauvin to get his knee off of Mr. Floyd's neck, even as they were on the scene and had been called. But the compassion with those, and I heard the testimony, was the one individual, the one gentleman said that he really worked really hard on Mr. Floyd to try to get him back to life. And when he was asked why, his words were, because he was human and I wanted to give him that second chance of life. Those were his words. So you do have individuals who are, you know, he's white, and you do have individuals who, in their profession, they are trying to do, you know, what they can do. The reason why they took Mr. Floyd away was so that they could be in an area where they can just fully concentrate on doing what they had to do for him, not just leave and take him to the hospital, but so that they could have him in a secure place, move him where they could just fully focus all of their concentration on Mr. Floyd. So there are compassionate individuals there. But I wanted to backtrack on something that was said earlier in terms of the other caller. I think his name was Rob from Baltimore.
Yes.
And he had made the comment about, you know, is it any training different for white officers and black officers? the officers that were in the Freddie Gray case, for which they were tried, were they black officers? Not all of them, but the ones that were, you know, that were the major trials that were charged, they were black officers. And they really didn't have, even though they were found not guilty, the two black officers, they didn't have any regard for Mr. Gray. So I don't think we can just always look at it as it's white versus black when it comes to police officers.
Okay. Great point. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are talking about the Derek Chauvin murder trial in Minneapolis, the former Minneapolis police officer who is on trial for murder in the death of George Floyd. Let's go to Julie, calling from Maryland. Julie, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hello, Eastern Shore, Julie Marshall calling in. I'm one of the Live Squad girls during the day, but I just wanted to say that it was a murder that we all saw. It was very clear. His daughter stated that George Floyd will change the world, and he will. It is time, more than time, out of all the murders of color, all the murders from women to men to whatever, and poor people too. It's really not just of color, but it is color. And it is now going to come out in the open, and God is going to take care of this. And the officers that came forward, the three men, they are heroes because no blue has ever turned against blue. And praise God, honesty. But they couldn't lie. There was no way anybody cannot say that it's murder. 9 minutes and 29 seconds. Murder.
Okay. Julie, thank you so much for your phone call. Julie makes an interesting point, Tim, about the statement about George Floyd changing the world. We are in the midst of huge considerations about police reform. Just last week, a police reform document was finished here in the District of Columbia. Dozens and dozens of recommendations in Prince George's County a week or so ago. The police reform being considered there as a new police chief was announced. And now we have George Floyd's family at the Texas Capitol, and they are calling on state lawmakers to pass police reform. Of course, we have the H.R. 7120, the George Floyd bill. So is it possible that no matter what the outcome of this trial, his death has already created a wave of consideration when it comes to police reform?
Well, you know, I've been around for a long time. And number one, before I get into my historical discussion, let me talk about the George Floyd bill. I pray that it gets passed because we need a uniform approach to law enforcement across the country. I handle cases all across the country, and Bob here and I weave there because different policies and procedures, different policies are in place as it relates to use of force. And so there's some things that have to be uniform all across the country, number one. Number two is that I hope that the vigor stays. I've been through the Rodney King insurrection or the riots and the same discussion that was had 29 years ago. And we're still having the same discussion today. Today. So nothing has changed. So I hope that, you know, that we will, it's not an emotional clarion call, but it's a serious clarion call that there will be change. And that's what I'm looking for. I'm tired of hearing about the rhetoric, and I want to see, we need to quit talking about it and be about it and see some change coming in this country. And I support a federal approach to law enforcement in that what happens in California happens in New York and all in between. So it's a uniform approach to true and meaningful reform as it relates to law enforcement.
But union leaders in police organizations across this country will argue that police reform laws may hamstring them when we are talking about criminals. And I'm not talking about, you know, the George Floyds who are accused of passing a counterfeit $20 bill. I'm talking about the armed to the teeth criminals that are on the street that are, you know, changing our communities, changing the street color from black to red in our communities across this country. And they would argue that these reforms prevent them from doing their jobs. Are criminals now more dangerous? Do you believe that reform may be hamstringing officers?
Well, let me say this. The unions can't be controlled. They, you know, they're like a little small dog with a big bark. The things they can be controlled. It's the unions have this them and us mentality. When the blacks were in law enforcement, we had problems with the unions. The blacks had problems with the unions because they were going against the edicts of or the concerns of the cries of the black communities. So the thing is that you and how you control that by putting the proper individuals in position to make these laws and hopefully. If the federal government comes in and do what it's supposed to do, that will take a whole bunch of teeth out of these unions. Now they're good for getting law enforcement raises and all the other stuff, but when it comes down to doing what is needed for their respective communities, more specifically the communities of color, they're absent. They're sitting behind a desk somewhere. They're not out there in the street. They're absent. They don't know what these needs are. So if you have the right people at the table, the unions can be controlled. Mm. And I'm not too worried about that. What I'm worried about is getting the proper reform in this country. And once you get the proper reform in this country, you'll be taking the teeth out of the union.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are taking a look at the trial of Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis police officer charged with the murder of George Floyd. Debbie, let's go back to the courtroom. What are you seeing from the perspective of the defense? As when we're talking about, you know, cross-examination and, you know, questions raised about drug use, drug abuse, and George Floyd's past.
So, the defense has, on the one hand, an easier job than the prosecution. And we've, you know, bouncing around the word slam dunk. When I prosecuted, we never thought of any case as being a slam dunk because the prosecution has to convince 12 people to reach the same conclusion. And I have friends, and when we could go out pre-pandemic, we couldn't even decide on going to the same movie. It's not easy to get 12 people to agree to the same charges to convict someone. And so all the defense really has to do is to create doubt. If they can create doubt in one person's mind, that former Officer Chauvin is not guilty, then they get a hung jury. And Derek Chauvin gets to live another day, at least live another day as a free man. And then on the other hand, their other strategy is, well, if we can't get that one juror who will not convict of any of the charges, then what we want to do is to at least have jurors that are more in support of the police officer, and therefore they will refuse to convict on either second degree or third degree murder. And their job would have been successful if they could even get it down to a manslaughter verdict, albeit a verdict. And so what they will do in that regard, and some of this stuff that they've tried to do already, I think is falling probably hopefully on deaf ears, is say that the crowd was unruly when we saw in the video that, you know, there really wasn't that much of a crowd, and they certainly were not unruly. But their whole focus is going to be on what we call causation, and that is what caused the death of George Floyd. And so that's why you hear them keep talking about he had a heart attack. He was COVID-19 positive. He had drugs in his system. His heart just gave out on him after he had had a knee held on it for 9 minutes and 29 seconds. So those are the things that they're going to harp on. And we haven't really seen the defense at their best in terms of defense, because that really will not come until the state medical examiner takes the stand and testifies for the prosecution. I would think that that person would more than likely be the last witness for the prosecution, unless they used one of George Floyd's family members as the last witness. But that's why the defense is bringing up all these other things that they can bring up in terms of, you know, heart attack, excited delirium, you know, anything and everything that they can throw, so that if there is one favorable juror who's leaning favorably more towards the police officer just because he is a police officer, then they would have something to go into that jury room and fight with the others on.
Help me with the charges, Debbie. Chauvin is facing second-degree unintentional felony murder, third-degree depraved mind murder, and second-degree manslaughter. That, you know, you don't hear the complexities of those things on Law and Order. What you know, you don't. I mean, what is unintentional felony murder and depraved mind murder?
So, here's where I differ with the prosecution, but we have to start with the charge that he wasn't charged with in order to understand the other charges. So I felt that he should have been charged with first-degree murder. It was a first-degree murder case if I've ever seen one. There's no doubt in my mind about that. As a former prosecutor, we've gotten first-degree murder cases against people who shot at someone 8 times. And here was someone who held the man down for 8 minutes and 29 seconds, because first-degree murder is what's called premeditated. It's intentional. You intended the person to die, and you thought about it. It doesn't mean that you planned it last week, you know, 2 days ago, the day before, whatever. It just means that the intent can be formed at the time that you were there. So he wasn't charged with first degree. So second degree is unintentional. And so what that means is that you didn't intend to kill him, so to speak, as in first degree, where it's an intent crime, but nonetheless, it was a homicide, which is what the medical examiner ruled, which is an unlawful killing, and someone died, Mr. Floyd. Then there's third degree, which is really that your depraved heart is a legal term. You just don't hear that often. It means that your actions were so outrageous that there is no way that you did not know that your outrageous actions would cause serious bodily harm, and in this case, death. And then there's manslaughter. And manslaughter, the easiest way to break it down is just to say it's an accident. You didn't intend for the person to die, which is first degree. It wasn't like an unintentional second degree. It wasn't that your actions were so egregious. It really was just an accident that they died. Mm-hmm. And that's what the defense is really going to argue, and that's why they're using everything under the sun to say it was everything else, and then Mr. Floyd died. The difference is in the penalties for the charges are first degree in Minnesota carries life in prison, and that's what he should have been charged with, because that is what he was guilty of, is from what I've seen in the case. Second degree in Minnesota is 45 years. Third degree is, I believe, 25 years. Manslaughter is far less. I don't recall the exact maximum penalty. But at the end of the day, there's this thing called the sentencing guidelines. And even if Chauvin is convicted, it's highly unlikely that a judge is going to sentence him to, you know, 40 years for second degree or 25 years or even for manslaughter, and that the sentencing guidelines for a person who has never been convicted of anything before, if he were convicted of the highest charge, he's probably in the range of 12 to 15 years.
You know, that third degree depraved mind murder sounds, to put it simply, it sounds like, oh, it's the you're a terrible person and you killed somebody. And I think, and I'm not in any way making light of this, but based on, your definition, which is not to say, first degree, you said it, someone formed in their mind that they were going to kill someone. But I see the subtlety where in the depraved mind at the time, and correct me if I'm wrong, during the course of the act, you had an opportunity to make a decision to stop or not to stop, and you decided not to stop. In other words, depraved mind, terrible person, ending in the death of someone. Am I on point there?
Yeah, correct. Yeah. Correct.
Thank
correct.
You.
Correct.
Back to the phone lines. Ronald, calling from West Virginia. Ronald, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I just have a comment about the prosecutor.
Go right ahead.
I just don't believe that there is like a pit bull. They told prosecutors normally is like a pit bull when they're going after average citizens. They going after them. And with this guy, they kind of like, not going after them. Like even down to like day three about the urine on the ground. Like when somebody, I've seen people pass away or get shot or whatever. And, it takes the ambulance a while to get there. And their bowels are break or either they are urinated on the ground. And that's the way you can tell that a person has expired. And they've not once brought that up.
You know, Ronald, I think you make an excellent point, Debbie. I want to go back to you about that because other than the older gentleman who had broken down on the stand, he made a passing reference to what may have appeared to be urine on the ground. I think that was him. But why do you believe that that has not come up? And does Ronald make a point about prosecutors being more aggressive, or have we been watching, too much Law and Order in expecting prosecutors to be more theatrical, more dramatic, more passionate in eliciting testimony from witnesses?
Okay, I think you've been watching too much Law and Order.
Mm-hmm.
I think the prosecution is doing an excellent job, and you have to understand that the nuances of trial differs from what location you're in. So how a prosecutor would try a case in the District of Columbia, Baltimore, Maryland, would differ from how a prosecutor would try a case in Minneapolis or some other area. Minneapolis, and I've been to Minneapolis, is majority white. So the nuances of how they know their jury, let me just put it this way. So they know how they have to respond to their jury. These are seasoned prosecutors, and they've been doing cases for quite a long time. So they're relating to their jurors, not what you see on TV, not what you may have seen if you go to court in the city that you live in, because this is not Baltimore. It's not, Richmond. It's not New York City. It's Minneapolis. That's number one. Number two, to address the other issue, they're going with what is a scientific medical evidence. And so if a medical doctor can't say that, he was expired at the time, he had passed away at the time because his water broke, they're not going to bring that up. That's maybe what we think, but if that's not something that a doctor or the medical examiner can definitively address medically, they're held to that standard, yeah. Not to the way we think it is.
But Ronald, thank you so much for your comment. Tim, I only have a minute or so left. I'll let you have the last word. Your thoughts about where we are, week one done, week two started. From your perspective, where are we in this trial?
This is for Tim?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I think that the foundation has been laid. I think what you're going to have is now you're going to have the battle of the experts, the medical experts. There is a police procedure that's on deck for the prosecution. I think that they have laid the foundation for the out of policy, and it was wrong, and the fact that what Chauvin did was not what he was trained to do. So I don't think you need to bring someone in to talk about that. You bring them in if there wasn't a police officers or a department personnel willing to talk about that. The thing is that you're going to look at the medical, and it's going to get very interesting now because they're going to the defense is going to try to discredit the doctors that the prosecution will bring on, and then they will bring doctors on. They, being the defense, will bring their doctors on when they have their case in chief to offset what the prosecution has done. So the thing is that we got to pay attention to what the medical person will have to say, and the jury. The jury has to make a credibility decision as to who's most credible, the prosecution's medical personnel or the defense doctor's personnel. And remember that Eric Nelson's approach is twofold, common sense and reasonable doubt. All he needs is one. All he needs is one, and his case, the case is his. And that's important.
Debbie Hines, Timothy Williams, thank you both for talking to us. We appreciate your time. We will continue to watch this trial.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That is the Daily Drum on Sirius XM, Channel 141 for this Monday, April 5th. I'm Harold Fisher. Now, stay tuned for Unheard with Wes Hall.